From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Life isn't fair. No news there. But this country has always stood out as a place that was, well, pretty fair. Americans have prided themselves, or sought to, especially on fairness in the rule of law. Fairness, said Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, is what justice really is. Journalist Matt Taibbi says, look around. Our great age of inequality, he says, is undercutting fairness, justice itself in America. The rich walk, the poor are criminalized, he says. This hour on Point, American Justice in the Age of Inequality. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you see it? A deepening double standard in American justice. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Matt Taibbi, reporter, author, muckraker. He reported on Wall Street crimes and scams for Rolling Stone magazine for about a decade. He's now joined First Look Media to start up a new digital magazine focusing on political and financial corruption. His new book is called The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Matt Taibbi, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What's your case?
Well, this book grew out of my experience covering Wall Street dating back to the crash of 2008, and I had spent a lot of time covering one caper after another where people working at major financial institutions committed fraud in the billions, and the punchline of all my stories I started to notice over time were the same. Nobody got indicted, nobody went to jail. And around the time of the Occupy protests, I decided to write a book about this. And in doing the research, I had to learn about who does go to jail in this country and for what. And I ended up with this kind of shocking contrast in how the criminal justice system works on the one side and how it doesn't work on the other. And that's what The Divide is all about. It's a catalog of how people who are very, very wealthy avoid criminal prosecution in jail, and how everybody else ends up in jail.
You write, more and more often we all make silent calculations about who is entitled to what rights and who is not. It's not as simple, you write, as saying everyone's the same under the law anymore. We all know there's another layer to it now. What's that layer, Matt?
Well, this is an observation that for me came from my time. I'm actually old enough to have gone to college in the Soviet Union. I went and studied in what was then Leningrad in 1990, and I remembered very vividly learning quickly that there were two sets of rules. There were the official laws that everybody mostly ignored, and then there was an unwritten set of rules that were the important ones. So in the morning, there would be the kids outside our dormitories who would try to trade rabbit hats and military gear for blue jeans. And a couple of times a week, those kids would get arrested because it was illegal to have foreign products and illegal to do trading of that kind. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the directors of the university would walk right past those same policemen wearing foreign suits and blue jeans, and nobody would ever say a thing. And so, you know, I learned that Soviets had internalized a set of values that certain people just don't get in trouble for certain things, and certain people do get in trouble for certain things. And I think I'm starting to recognize the same phenomenon happening now in the United States. If you think about what happened last year, for instance, with J.P. Morgan Chase, where there were $20 billion in fines levied against the company for a variety of offenses, or HSBC a couple of years ago, which paid a $1.9 billion fine for, among other things, laundering $850 million for a pair of Central and South American drug cartels. Mm-hmm. We just don't think of certain people as being the kinds of people who go to jail. We think of them as the kinds of people who pay fines and settle, whereas other people are the kinds of people who go to jail. So the ordinary street dealer who is also in the illegal narcotics game, that person goes to jail, whereas HSBC, you know, they were in the illegal drugs game as well, but those guys didn't go to jail. So I think it's kind of the same thing. It's not quite as drastic, but it's significant, I think.
You describe looking around and seeing a kind of crazy formula of poverty, crime, and prison populations that alerted you to maybe something being off kilter here.
Yes, there's a bizarre set of statistical mysteries that have been plaguing the United States for a couple of decades now, dating back to 1990. Violent crime in America has actually been dropping at a fairly rapid rate. It's 44% since 1990, according to federal statistics. But in that same time period, the prison population has more than doubled. It's gone from about 1 million people to somewhere between 2.2 and 2.3 million people. So it doesn't make sense. And during the same period of time, of course, economic hardship and poverty have also risen. So this is another counterintuitive set of parameters, because you would expect that as things get harder for people, that crime would actually increase. That hasn't been the case. Crime has gone down, and yet we have more people in jail, and it's a very strange set of circumstances that doesn't make sense, according to a lot of statisticians who can't find a reason for this.
I think a lot of people who don't have your gritty, skeptical view of life may look at this or be encouraged by our system to look at this and say, well, you know, the lapses at the top, they're kind of gauzy misdemeanors. We're not sure what they are. They're vague. And the crimes at the bottom are real. So, of course, there's a prison population with a lot of poor folks. And of course, it's more subtle at the top.
Well, I understand that point of view. It's not correct, but I understand it. And that mainly comes from a lack of understanding about what actually happened in the financial services sector leading up to the crash of 2008 and in the period since. But let's just take the same crime, fraud, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at people who are, a single mom on welfare, and she gets caught in, let's say, an $800 welfare fraud. Maybe the state overpaid her and she forgot to pay back, or maybe she checked the wrong box in her application and said she didn't have a boyfriend who was living with her, and it turned out that a neighbor says that she did. The woman will inevitably pay 100% restitution for that fraud. Mm-hmm. She may lose custody of her children, and she may face prison time. I found women who did face prison time who were in that situation. Meanwhile, the same, fraud on a much, much huger scale involving all the companies involved with the subprime mortgage fraud, which was, a highly elaborate criminal scheme that was based on creating huge masses of toxic subprime loans that were of very low quality, disguising them as AAA rated securities, and then selling them off to institutional investors like pension funds. Essentially, what they were doing was selling bad securities to retired people, among other things, and ripping them off. And that was fraud too. But we wouldn't even think to take the custody of children away from the people who committed that kind of fraud, and none of them faced any jail time. And restitution in that part of the world is never 100%. If the fine is $1 billion, you can bet that the profit was $30 billion. And so it doesn't make any sense. It's completely counterintuitive. And so even when it's the same crime, we see this radical, radical difference in the approaches.
It can sound kind of like wonky policy stuff when you describe it, but it reads nothing like that in your book. I mean, this is visceral, deep injustice, as you describe it. You describe the criminalization of the poor broadly, and this kind of just broad exemption of the rich who are working the edge here. People sort of going through the underwear drawers of people who have almost nothing and stopping at the tall iron gates of those who have everything.
Right. Yeah, no. And this gets to, how you cover a story. I think when I first envisioned writing this book, I had already, again, for years been covering a lot of these stories where people committed, high level white collar capers and weren't prosecuted for them. But that was mostly sort of an intellectual exercise for me. I didn't really get to see a whole lot of the victims of those schemes. Mm. And it didn't register for me on a personal level. But when I, You know, when I, for instance, the, one of the things you referred to there was the underwear drawer story. That was a program in San Diego where people who apply for welfare, they can be preemptively searched by the state, which claims that it has an interest in making sure that people are telling the truth about, for instance, not having a live-in boyfriend who is helping with the bills. And so they'll send an officer to the to a woman's house and go through their things. And I talked to this one woman who vividly described an officer reaching into her underwear drawer with a pencil end and holding up a pair of panties and saying, "Who do you need these for?" And in other words, you know, if you don't have a boyfriend, what's this for? And that's just so violative and so offensive. And then you think about, on the other hand, a bank that has taken a federal bailout, which is also a kind of welfare recipient, and we don't even have the ability to go in and look at their books, much less do, you know, go through their underwear drawers. It's a stark, stark contrast, and that's when you start getting angry, you know, and I think that's where that that approach came from.
You're writing or describing what you put forward as a kind of fundamental corruption going on of our justice system.
Yes, and I think it's less of a sort of Dr. No, Dr. Evil situation than maybe it sounds like at first blush. You know, I think a lot of these things sort of started to happen organically over time. There are a number of different reasons why it evolved this way, but yes, we've got two different justice systems, one for the poor and one for the rich, and it's very, very upsetting.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about American justice in the great age of inequality. My guest, Matt Taibbi, says the rich get off and the poor get criminalized. Locked up. His new book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Matt Taibbi joins us from New York. Matt, response for you online here. Here's one listener who says, in a capitalist society, it is impossible to prevent the influence of money in the justice system. Legislate all you like, but the influence of wealth is part of the fabric of our society. Kind of an argument that it was ever thus, Matt.
You know, that's an interesting argument. And of course, it's always been easier for the rich and it's always been harder for the poor. And I would imagine that there have been upswings and downswings and peaks and valleys throughout our history and where this problem has been worse and the problem has been better. But I would make the argument that in the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen a dramatic worsening of this problem, and that it's illustrated very starkly by three episodes. First is the savings and loan crisis, which was sort of like the subprime mortgage crisis, a vast nationwide problem involving financial fraud. But in the wake of that crisis, we had over 1,000 prosecutions and we put over 800 people in jail. You fast forward about a decade after that to the next round of scandals, the big ones, which were the accounting scandals of the late 90s and early 2000s. Even the Bush administration rounded up the heads of companies like Tyco and Adelphia and WorldCom and Enron and Arthur Andersen. And there were high-level prosecutions of those companies. It wasn't as much as there were after the SNL crisis, but they still had them. And then fast forward to now, after the 2008 crisis, which dwarfed the other two crises in seriousness and in damage. I mean, there are some statistics that say that the fraud that caused the crash wiped out 40% of the world's wealth during that time. And how many people have been put in jail? Zero. So there's been a dramatic change, and I think it's exemplified by the kind of person who inhabits the regulatory structure now. It used to be that prosecutors were prosecutors. They went after rich and poor, black and white. There was an attitude that the law enforcement officials had that was sort of universal. And they've been replaced at the high levels, at the white-collar level, by a new kind of person who comes from the corporate defense community. And they really are more deal-makers than prosecutors. And that's why we're seeing more settlements.
There's been a kind of a philosophical shift that you describe here that may be behind some of this. I want to look at the bottom and the top. At the top level, you describe a young Justice Department official, I think in the Clinton administration, named Eric Holder, talking about we have to be careful about what he called collateral consequences if and when we set out to prosecute those of great economic weight.
Right, yes. Way back in the late 90s, then Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder in the Clinton administration wrote a memo that came to be known as the affectionately as the Holder memo. It actually was originally a sort of get tough on crime document because it gave prosecutors a number of tools they could use to go after corporate offenders. But at the bottom of it, it also laid out that collateral consequences policy. And all it really said was is that if you're a prosecutor and you're targeting a big company that employs a lot of people and maybe has a lot of shareholders, and you're worried about victimizing innocent people, in other words, executives who weren't part of the wrongdoing or the shareholders or members of the community that might be affected, then you can seek other forms of other remedies apart from criminal prosecutions, like fines or deferred prosecution agreements or non-prosecution agreements. And that makes sense. But the problem is that they're now applying it virtually in all cases because we have so many of these too big to fail companies now that it is difficult to envision prosecuting these firms without doing great damage to the world economy. I would argue that there are two reasons why that policy doesn't make sense now. One is that they use that excuse the first time, like they did with HSBC after they were caught laundering money for drug cartels, part of the settlement should have been you have to break up and become smaller so that next time you do this, we can put you in jail. Mm. And the other thing is that you know, morally, it just doesn't work if some people get off with fines and you consider the consequences for those. For the victims of those companies, but you don't consider the consequences for the ordinary person who gets put in jail for a lesser offense and what happens to his or her family. And I think that's a double standard, and we have to worry about it.
Worry too much about collateral consequences in the economy. It can mean a free pass for some. U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, seen as a pretty tough guy in Manhattan, and here he was with that Eric Holder, the Holder memo language, just this last January, sort of channeling that doctrine of collateral consequences, explaining why law enforcement must sometimes pull its punches when pursuing white-collar criminals.
You take into account all factors. You take into account the legitimate law enforcement need to have deterrence and to holding people accountable and to bringing money back to victims and to making sure that the punishment is proportional to what the conduct was. And when you're talking about an institution, we also have to take into account, as we're required to, potential collateral consequences.
Collateral consequences still on the mind of the prosecutor right there. What about at the other end? I mean, you make a pretty strong claim that we have, by inattention or by design, you tell me, criminalized the poor. What do you really mean by that?
Well, we've instituted all across the country, we have these new statistics-based policing strategies where most people have heard of the broken windows theory of policing. And the idea there is that if you arrest people for very small things, then they will be less likely to commit serious crimes. The example they usually give is, if you know that you're going to be arrested for jumping a turnstile in a subway, you're less likely to bring an illegal gun out into the street because you don't want to be caught for that when you're caught for doing something really small and stupid at the same time. And so this began in the early 90s, it created this new system of policing in the inner cities. And people here in New York City and in cities all across America, especially in minority communities, they know all about what this is. A couple of years ago, just to give you an example, in New York, they stopped and frisked 680,000 people, 88% of which were black or Hispanic. They handed out 600,000 summonses for things like carrying an open container. That were 80,000 summonses for that. 20,000 for riding the wrong way down a sidewalk on a bicycle. 50,000 for marijuana, even though that's decriminalized in New York City. You can actually carry a joint legally. But if they ask you to empty your pockets and suddenly it's in plain view, then it's illegal all of a sudden. So what they're basically doing is throwing a net over whole communities, dragging everybody in. They're looking for guns and for warrants for people who are fugitives. And the idea is to throw the innocent ones back, but in practice, they don't always do that. What they end up doing instead is proceeding with these really stupid cases involving minor infractions like carrying an open container or, in the case of one person that I interviewed for my book, obstructing pedestrian traffic, which it turns out is a very common offense that you can be stopped for in New York, which basically means being black on a Tuesday night. You have a guy who's standing in front of his own house listening
to music. At 1 a.m. in your story, not much pedestrian traffic then.
Yeah, he was literally standing in front of his own house with a friend listening to music. They were sharing a set of headphones, and this guy's a bus driver. He's wearing a tie. He's got his ID around his neck. He's a working man who just came home, and the police just didn't like the looks of him, and they arrested him and wrote him up for obstructing pedestrian traffic. And I met this man in a law office, and like most white people in New York, I had no idea that you could be arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic or that such a law even existed. But it turns out that's a very common offense in this city, and it's just part of what the city councilman in Baltimore described as an epidemic of false arrest in the inner cities, where policemen cook up all kinds of spurious probable cause reasons to stop and arrest people, and this is the norm in the inner cities. And I tell these stories to contrast it with the lack of attention that people get when they work in the financial services industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, where it's very, very difficult to get law enforcement interested in a case, even if they're very, very serious.
And with that, you may have, Matt Taibbi says, the criminalization of the poor and a kind of free pass society emerged here for the wealthy when they press the edges of the law. Matt Taibbi, stand by in New York. I want to get some perspective on this. Arthur Leiby joins us right now from Camden, New Jersey. He's professor of law at Rutgers, specializes in securities law and regulation. Professor Leiby, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
What do you make of Matt Taibbi's depiction of the sort of economic halls of power being almost exempt from a legal prosecution and imprisonment, even when wrong is done while we criminalize the poor? How's that hit your ear, Professor Leiby?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Fundamentally, I don't necessarily disagree with much of what Matt Taibbi says, and I always look forward to his writings. But I do think that the situation is a bit more complex and more subtle than it might appear at first blush. So, for example, there have been significant high-level prosecutions of white-collar crime that many of us have seen over the past few years. The government prosecuted Raj Rajaratnam for insider trading. He was convicted in 2011. He was sentenced to 11 years in prison. McKinsey director Rajat Gupta was sentenced to 2 years in jail. The prosecutors recently charged SAC Capital Advisors with insider trading. The firm settled for $1.8 billion in penalties, but more importantly, eight current or former employees of the firm were charged and were convicted or pleaded guilty, some of whom will most certainly go to jail. Also, I think just as importantly, there's been, I think, a sea change in the way many of these investigations are carried out, which I think is not clear if you look at Mr. Taibbi's writing. So in white-collar cases, I think there's been a change, perhaps a change for the better, where the government is really using tactics that were traditionally reserved for organized crime and gang prosecutions and really getting very, very tough on white-collar crime through using wiretaps, which they did in the case of Mr. Rajaratnam, use of informers, use of undercover and sting operations. That's really a significant change in the way investigations are carried out. The investigations are being done not necessarily after the fact, but really simultaneously with the carrying out of the crime. And these are all, I think, significant changes which reflect that we do take white-collar crime seriously, and the government pursues it fairly aggressively.
Matt, what do you make of that? Raj Rajaratnam, Mr. Gupta, the SAC fine, and eight employees, former employees, some may go to jail, so there's the bite of justice.
Not one of those instances had anything to do with the financial crisis of 2008. Those were insider trading cases. They could have happened in any era, in any period. And many of the principals, especially Stevie Cohen, involving SAC, he's going to walk away with an enormous fortune, almost no matter what happens in that case. And when you're talking about using tactics against that they use against organized crime and against gangs, how come there haven't been any RICO prosecutions against any of these companies? The only RICO case that I could find that involved mortgages in the last 5 or 6 years involved a Lincoln Park gangster in Los Angeles who had a RICO case pushed against him for trafficking in some kind of mortgage scam at a very, very low level. But none of these banks that were involved in wide-ranging subprime mortgage fraud have been prosecuted at all. And again, nobody who was connected to the systemic frauds that led to the crisis has faced any kind of prosecution. There was only one prosecution that one could even call related to the financial crisis, and that was a pair of Bear Stearns employees. They worked for a Bear Stearns-related hedge fund. They were acquitted in a Los Angeles court. And after that case, there really hasn't been anything criminal.
Arthur Leiby, are you cherry-picking these high-profile prosecutions? Do you have a concern that there's a wider laxity about justice at this level of our society?
No, if we're talking about criminal cases as a result of the financial crisis, then fundamentally I don't disagree with what Matt Taibbi says. There have been some SEC cases. Those have generally been against institutions. Those cases are typically settled. But I think the more important point is that there are really very significant challenges in bringing criminal cases and, for that matter, SEC cases that try to allege fraud. And if you compare it with the SNL crisis, there's really quite a big difference. I mean, much of what was done during the financial crisis was unfortunately legal. And so to bring a criminal case, this is quite complicated. One needs to have the right evidence. One needs to be able to show intent. Intent means proving that the defendants had a particular state of mind. And just because in our legal system, just because bad things happen, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's enough evidence to bring a criminal case.
Let me ask you this. I take your point. Matt quotes in the front piece of his book, Justice Potter Stewart, saying, fairness is what justice really is. It may be difficult, and I don't doubt that, but given the way our law is arranged today, are we achieving fairness in the terms that Matt's describing here between classes?
Well, fairness is, as you can imagine, a very sort of open-ended term, and what is fairness to one person is not fairness to another person. So certainly if we look at certain aspects of society, and I won't get into the details that Mr. Taibbi has, then sure, we could make arguments that there is certainly in some areas a lack of general overarching fairness. And indeed, I think it's great that Matt Taibbi makes this part of the conversation. But I think to the extent that he suggested earlier that, well, you have, you know, government officials who just aren't acting aggressively enough because they come from the private sector. I just speaking personally, I don't necessarily buy that thesis. Sure, the government should enforce its conflict of interest rules better. I don't disagree with that, but I don't agree that government officials are necessarily soft on white-collar crime due to this so-called revolving door. And there's evidence to the contrary. You know, there's a 2012 study from some accountants that demonstrated that, in fact, this so-called revolving door, people moving from government to the private sector, that it's actually helpful because government officials want to show that they're quite aggressive, and taking a hard line and being tough is actually more likely to influence a future employer. Who would you want to hire? Would you want to hire the person who kind of doesn't take direction and is soft on everybody? Or would you want to hire the official who, when they are in office, they're quite aggressive and they really go after the wrongdoers? That's who one might want to say, gee, we want to bring those folks on board in the long run.
Arthur Leiby, professor of law at Rutgers. We're going to put those points to Matt Taibbi. I appreciate your raising them with us here today. Thank you very much for joining us from Camden.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American justice in the great age of inequality. My guest, Matt Taibbi, says the rich get off and the poor get criminalized as a class, and many, many locked up, more than in any culture, any society in history, he points out, in the United States today. His new book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt, there are issues from Professor Leiby I want to raise, but we've got a lot of callers waiting as well. Dave in Madison, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. So I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I wanted to cite an example from experience that seems to reveal a double standard.
Okay.
Mr. Taibbi had mentioned the HSBC money laundering case and the $1.9 billion settlement, I believe, which as a fraction of the profit, you know, is only a fraction of the profits they made off of that.
These were accusations that they transferred billions for countries like Iran. They enabled Mexican drug cartels to move money illegally through American subsidiaries. Yeah.
Yeah, they're not accusations. They admitted it.
Admitted, yes.
Right, and senior-level executives basically willfully ignored or knowing did this. And I would contrast that with a street-level drug dealer in federal court. And what you have is if the feds suspect that a defense attorney is being paid out of proceeds from drug sales, the feds can and do seek to confiscate the attorney's fee under those circumstances.
Okay.
And we can I think, well know how that might affect the quality of representation that a street-level drug dealer might receive.
That's going to scare off a lot of attorneys right there, Dave.
Certainly. And you know, when you see the contrast there, that's striking. And the other thing I'd just say is that, you know, if you're a street-level drug dealer, deterrence isn't as effective in my experience. But when you have senior executives in these major companies, the threat of going to jail, if real and perceived to be real, really does have a deterrent effect. And so you have a sort of upside-down incentive system, which I think cannot be effective in conduct at the highest level. So that's all I'd have to say about that, but it seems like a striking example.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, Dave. Different qualities of representation with radically different outcomes suggested there, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely, and I've heard actually that same argument made to me before, and I've also heard an argument made from the other side of the table. I spoke with a former federal prosecutor who did a lot of high level drug cases. He used to work in Florida back in the sort of the 80s and the cocaine days, and he told me that as a matter of course, when they wanted to add a whole bunch of years to a suspect in a drug case, they just charge him with money laundering, and they would get 10, 15 extra years in those cases. So it's not unusual. If you can just look online and Google money laundering and conviction, and look at people who've gotten lots and lots of years for this offense. And again, in this case, you have one of the worst money laundering cases, drug money laundering cases in the history of narcotics investigations, and nobody got even one day. So it's just harder to have a more stark contrast than that.
I mean, it's not just Matt Taibbi saying this. I'm reading here from William C. Dudley, president and chief executive officer. This is from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. These are remarks last fall in New York. He's talking about, he says, an important problem evident within some large financial institutions, the apparent lack of respect for law, regulation, and the public trust. There's evidence of deep-seated cultural and ethical failures at many large financial institutions. And he goes on in that vein. And this is, I mean, you have a reputation as a pretty hot writing pistol. This is, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York saying it.
Oh, yeah. No, and presidents of Fed branches all over the country have been saying the same thing. Look, the reason that this is important is that when there was no response, no criminal response to 2008, what could you have predicted? You could have predicted that even worse criminal behavior would have happened next, because people would have been emboldened to do even worse things. And that's exactly what has happened. We've seen far worse scandals since 2008. The LIBOR scandal, which involves worldwide manipulation of interest rates, involving some of the biggest financial companies in the world, it couldn't possibly be more serious than that. There's a similar scandal going on in the Forex markets. We've seen manipulation of metals prices. We're seeing all kinds of things that we never would have seen 10 years ago. And I think it has to be laid at the feet of the fact that we didn't prosecute people when we had the chance.
It can sound far away. You can imagine people shrugging, saying, well, okay, they'll make some more money, but life goes on. What's the difference, Matt?
because everybody is affected by corruption in the financial services sector, and most people aren't even aware of it. I mean, if you think about it, in 2008, let's just say that you were a typical working stiff, a toll booth operator in, I don't know, a state like Minnesota, and you look at your pension fund after the crash, and you see that your state pension is maybe dinged 30% or 40%. That might have been because some bank sold some batch of toxic, fraudulent securities to a state pension fund. So that's just theft. That's out and out fraud. You lost your money. You were a victim. Nowadays, it might be if you buy a can of soda, you might be paying too much for the aluminum in that can because of manipulation in the metals markets. If you have a mortgage, if you have a credit card, you might be affected by manipulation in the LIBOR markets. It's impossible to calculate the damage of all these crimes. They almost exist in an existential, ethereal level, and that's why they're hard to comprehend. But it does affect everybody, and people need to understand that they're essentially paying taxes, extra taxes for all this crime.
And at the other end of things, if you're on the wrong street at the wrong time, the wrong neighborhood, it may be much more concrete. You may be in jail. Scott in Boston. Scott, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Matt. Thank you for covering this conversation. I just wanted to add to this that in reality, what I haven't heard you talk about is race and economics. And I'd like, if you're touching upon that in your book, to touch upon it, because I do understand the financial crisis and the lack of prosecutions in there and the increase of prosecutions for standing on the street in front of your brownstone. So I wonder if you do cover that. I also think that, you know, you look at the meth epidemic and heroin, which are considered more of a suburban crime, and that's permeating throughout now. Is it because they were looking in the urban settings for the crack and the marijuana? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you, Scott. There's plenty on race in this book. Matt, speak to it.
Yeah, no, Scott, that's a great question, and obviously race plays a huge factor in all of this, and I think the place that I saw this most directly was in, you know, I spent a lot of time in courtrooms watching people be sentenced for everything from drug offenses to those dumb crimes like, you know, having an open container violation. There was a famous incident here in New York where a judge in the Bronx named Noah Deer just remarked as he was handing out a fine for an open container violation. He said, you know, I've never actually done one of these for a white person. And he had his staff look into it, and he found out that only 4% of all open container violations in New York were handed out to white people. But more importantly, all the judges, or most of the judges that I saw, they don't live in these communities. They come from Connecticut or from New Jersey or from other affluent communities. And so they tend not to sympathize with the people that they're judging. Whereas when you have executives who appear before, you know, federal courts, they tend to come from the same place culturally as the judges. And it's a very different sort of treatment. You see the judges very much sympathizing, at least on an intellectual level, with their attorneys and having sort of a, you know, intellectual colloquy with their attorneys, which you don't see in the criminal courts. And I think it's very, very important to understand the cultural differences play a huge role in this.
Shakespeare nailed it pretty well, the risk here in King Lear. Plate sin with gold and the strong lance of justice hurtless breaks. No pain. David in Cambridge, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah,
hi, David, you're on. It sounds like David may be paying a toll. Sorry, David. Let's go to Gloria in Canandaigua, New York. Gloria, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, this is Gloria. And I'm so grateful for you writing this book, Matt. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gloria.
I haven't been, you know, directly, we've all been affected, but I haven't been directly affected in the ways that you have described. But what I want to know, I haven't read your book, is if you talk about Ferdinand Pecora, you know, his investigation of the great crash, and, you know, how, I think that Nancy Pelosi even said, we need a new Ferdinand Pecora right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you talk about that at all, because he did go after the big guys or people who think that they're big because of the money that they manipulate.
Yeah, Gloria, thank you. Matt?
Yes, that's a great question. I do think we do need a new PCORA Commission. I mean, the response that we did have was the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. But the head of the FCIC, and I apologize, I'm blanking on his name right now, but I quote him in the book as noting sort of acidly that his budget was 1/7 of the budget for Oliver Stone's new movie, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps. So the FCIC, not only was it merely a fact-finding mission where it didn't have prosecutorial power, and the FCIC came up with some great stuff. I mean, if you read their reports, you will have a much fuller understanding of what happened in the financial crisis and the fraud that went on. But they didn't have prosecutorial power, and they weren't dragging people, you know, basically on the dock and dispensing justice. They were just trying to describe what took place. We haven't had an organized commission to go after the offenses of leading up to 2008. We've had a few sort of fledgling efforts, but they've been very, very poorly funded, and they haven't had the kind of backing that we saw after the great crash. And so your question is a great one.
Yeah, Gloria, thanks for your call. Kevin in Buffalo. Kevin, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I just had a quick point to make. I kind of disagree with the idea that there's two systems of justice for the rich and the poor. And the only reason I say that is because, sort of piggybacking off of what the professor you had on earlier said.
Yes.
When you're talking about taking away, putting someone in jail for a crime, the standard of proof that our system of justice have is fairly high as far as proof and showing intent and causation. Especially when you're talking about these high-level, very complex, almost conspiracies to defraud, you know, the Security Exchange Commission or what have you. And if you compare that to lower-level crimes where prosecutors can much more easily show those elements and prove that, for example, a drug dealer was selling drugs, you can show, you know, it's easier to say that person's guilty. So I wonder if that's not the problem, that there's just it's difficult for prosecutors, given limited resources, to prove that these high-level executives are guilty to a level that would put them in jail.
That is interesting in many ways, Kevin. Thank you. Matt, what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, let's just take the example of HSBC.
Again, the money laundering for Iran and drug cartels.
Right, drug cartels. And again, they were so brazen that the teller windows in their Mexican branches were specially fitted with holes that were designed to fit the boxes of cash that drug dealers were sliding through them. They admitted to the conduct. And here's what bothers me about this. Yes, the prosecutors all said on and off the record after that case that it would have been very difficult to bring these folks to court and get convictions against the individuals involved, that it's tough to follow the paper trail, and that money laundering cases are notoriously difficult, and blah, 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 blah. But my problem was when they did the press conference for that case, they weren't embarrassed. They were proud of the fact that they got a $1.9 billion settlement. They didn't get up there and apologize to the people of America that we didn't put these people in jail. So the problem for me is a question of attitude. They consistently find ways to settle with these folks, and it's always the same sort of paradox. Well, we had enough leverage to get $20 billion out of J.P. Morgan Chase last year, but we somehow didn't have enough evidence to get even one person in jail for one day. Or we had enough leverage to get the executives of UBS to pay us $1.5 billion for their role in the biggest antitrust and price-fixing scandal in history, which is the LIBOR scandal, but we didn't have enough leverage to get anybody to do a day in jail. So I don't buy it. I'm sorry. I mean, I get the fact that these cases are hard, but I've seen them take people to court in difficult cases. Like there was a municipal bond bid rigging case where they got convictions a couple of years ago. The people who were convicted in that case got out in a technicality later, but they did get convictions, so it's not impossible. And I think it's important to understand that.
Ken in Billerica, Massachusetts. Ken, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Taibbi, quickly, I don't have a lot of time. I disagree with a few points. First and foremost, the Justice Department crime statistics overwhelmingly state a disproportionate amount of crimes committed by, everybody knows, young black and Hispanic males. Therefore, why not keep the police into those neighborhoods? If your point is the police shouldn't be in those neighborhoods, then I think the residents should be asked. Because by and large, I would say most of them would say, yes, these are criminals we want off the street. Number two point, you cite the absurdity of the open container law. That container law was put on the books for a reason. It's been there a lot longer than you and I have been. And I'm sure while it seems absurd on its face to give an otherwise upstanding citizen like a bus driver a ticket, we're not going to throw common sense into the argument. Lastly, sir, the proof is in the pudding. Go to Times Square 25 years ago and go to Times Square now. Not too hard to see the difference. Not too hard to see what this type of policing creates.
Ken, we've got it. Our time is so short. Matt Taibbi, what do you say?
So I went to a college predominantly with a whole bunch of white people, and I grew up in white communities, and I saw every drug known to man being consumed by people, by my friends, by myself and my friends, and I never once ran into a policeman. If I had the same kind of policing in my communities that these folks have in Bedford-Stuyvesant or in South Bronx or in Harlem, I'd be doing time, I would be furious if I lived in those communities and I saw people like me walking around. If you wanted to sweep Lower Manhattan on any Friday or Saturday night, you'd find cocaine and ecstasy.
Wall Street, yeah.
In Wall Street, and in on half the people walking the streets, but that's not the people they're stopping and frisking. So, yes, you know the stats say that the crimes exist in those neighborhoods, but that's because they're stopping those people.
Matt, you say the system is broken. What happens if we don't fix it?
I just think this problem is going to get worse, and people will lose their faith in the justice system, and that's what the real crisis will be.
Talking social cohesion at that point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's why it's important to do these at least symbolic prosecutions of these high-level offenders so that people still believe, because, you know, society only functions when people believe that it's all going to work.
Matt Taibbi, you always make us think, and we're grateful for it. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Matt Taibbi's new book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.